From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Civil unrest erupted across the nation in the days following Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. President Lyndon Johnson ordered tens of thousands of federal troops onto the streets of Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, and other cities where crowds overwhelmed local police. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 was signed by Johnson the following week.
Now with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
That act proposed ending housing discrimination based on race, gender, religion, or nationality. 50 years later, we visited towns and cities across Georgia and heard over and over again that rapid development and rising housing costs have kept neighborhoods effectively segregated. Dan Immergluck is here to talk about the impact of that landmark legislation, particularly whether it's fulfilled its intent here in Georgia. He's professor in the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. And Dan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this was in the works. It was a culmination of the Civil Rights Act when the Fair Housing Act had been discussed in the legislature. It was a key initiative of Dr. King. So what was the case being made for the Fair Housing Act?
Well, the case was both one of racial equity and economic equity, that given the urban unrest and basically the accumulation of evidence that African Americans in particular could not live where they wanted to live, that we needed a very clear law that said racial discrimination and some other kinds of discrimination in the housing market, whether it's rental or home buying, was illegal.
So had any protections existed before it passed?
Really very little. There was a 19th century law that supposedly protected against discrimination just in home buying. It was never enforced. It was basically rejected by the Supreme Court when it was attempted to be used.
It was not an easy piece of legislation to pass. Here is historian Michael Beschloss on NPR discussing Johnson's push for the Fair Housing Act. Opposition from his aides said no.
And they said, why don't you just defer civil rights until 65 once you're safely reelected? And Johnson, to his great credit, said, what the hell is the presidency for if I can't use it for civil rights?
Why, Dan, was the Fair Housing Act so controversial?
Well, this is about where people live. And also, when it's about where people live, it's who goes to school with you and your kids. And, you know, both Johnson and King, Dr. King, both acknowledged that voting rights is difficult, employment rights is difficult, other civil rights are difficult, but perhaps the hardest was housing and where people were able to live.
Well, housing also involves a market, and it was vehemently opposed by real estate companies. How did they, lenders, other opposing parties, uphold segregation in housing?
Well, we have a long history of segregation by market actors. We have redlining going back to the 19th century, where certain neighborhoods are basically color-coded by lenders and no lending is done there, where African Americans are not made loans. That was then reinforced by the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s and going on, where even the federally insured loans would not be made to folks of color generally or into neighborhoods with even diverse racial characteristics.
Even the GI Bill, from what I understand, would not be in effect for men
of color. The GI Bill was definitely racially skewed. We put public housing predominantly in African American neighborhoods. There are all kinds of ways local governments use what we call exclusionary zoning to keep lower income people out of their neighborhoods. So it was this mix of private and public discrimination that was so powerful.
So with the Fair Housing Act, the federal government said, we're drawing a line in the sand, no more. But now, how do those discriminatory practices persist today?
Well, in fact, the Fair Housing Act, despite its great intentions, has made things better, but really on the margins and gradually. I would say that it's had more impact on the actions not complete impact, but some impact on the actions of overt discrimination by realtors, overt discrimination by lenders. There's still all kinds of ways to effectively discriminate that the Fair Housing Act could get at if it was enforced more strongly. But also the Fair Housing Act hasn't been used to address things like exclusionary zoning and other local government practices that maintain segregation. And it really could be used much more aggressively. But in fact, in the last 2 years, we've seen the federal government say we're explicitly not going to do that.
Can you just dig in a little bit further on exclusionary zoning, how that shows up now?
Yeah, so basically exclusionary zoning is the effective prohibition of different kinds of housing, especially apartment buildings, smaller housing, more affordable housing in usually middle and upper income neighborhoods or especially suburbs. And so if you can't afford to purchase a larger home or can't get access to a mortgage and there's only single family homes for purchase, you can't buy into or get into that neighborhood. And there's all kinds of ways that local governments use exclusionary zoning to try to maintain a certain population mix.
Georgia State Professor Dan Immergluck is with us. We're talking about the impact of the Fair Housing Act full 50 years later. Well, there is a lot of data on the effect of living in racially segregated neighborhoods on health, on life prospects. What do we know about that?
Yeah, the phrase that's been, I think, popularized by NPR in particular is segregation in everything. We know segregation, concentrated poverty, has adverse impacts on school performance, has adverse impacts on health, has adverse impacts on how police treat people who don't look like the folks in their communities, and has long-term economic impacts in terms of basically allowing folks to gain education, skills, and access to jobs. We know through a program called the Moving to Opportunity Program that happened in the 90s, that when young kids were moved into neighborhoods with better schools, with stronger economies, that over the long run, they did better in terms of their adult earnings.
Well, Dan, I know you in particular have done some study and research on how, especially after the financial downturn, how the boom that has come back to so many Georgia cities and towns since then has been disparately affecting people of color and white neighborhoods. Can you give us a little summary of that?
Sure. What happened was black neighborhoods especially, but neighborhoods of color were disproportionately targeted with subprime high-risk mortgages. Those mortgages went into default at extremely high rates, far higher than anything we had seen previously. That led to vacancies, that led to a flood of housing available that the market couldn't absorb, and that led to a downward spiral of property values. When the national recovery came in about 2011 and after, those neighborhoods had a much harder time coming back, partly because they were hit harder, but also nationally, mortgage markets had tightened up a lot and it became much harder, especially for folks of color, to get a mortgage. And so that exacerbated the problem. And what we've seen is it's taken much longer for African-American neighborhoods in particular to recover, partly because it's been hard to get a mortgage to buy homes in those neighborhoods. That's getting better slowly, but it really made a huge disparate impact in terms of housing wealth for folks of color. And so many more folks could have bought houses if we had reacted differently, both when the crisis happened and afterward.
So housing wealth, how much people have in equity.
That's right.
And that's actually pretty divergent. Even comparable houses in white neighborhoods or predominantly white zip codes, let's say, mm-hmm. and predominantly black zip codes.
Yes. So basically, we see much higher levels of housing equity in white neighborhoods. We see black neighborhoods housing equity really collapsed during the crisis. And again, until about 2015, 2014, it wasn't coming back. It is starting to come back now, and that's a good thing. But all those folks who could have bought houses at the kind of bottom of the cycle, many whites could, many blacks couldn't. And so we had a system that disproportionately negatively affected black communities on the way down and disproportionately benefited white buyers on the way up.
So the Fair Housing Act has changed somewhat since it was signed 50 years ago in 1988. It was amended to include people with disabilities and families with children. So you mentioned the 90s. There was a bit of a surge in programs. But what has been the impact in more recent decades?
I think pretty much since 2000, we've seen a stalling of progress. The foreclosure crisis, the subprime crisis set us back, I would say, decades. And that was due to the lack of regulation of these private mortgages, subprime mortgages. So we have to basically create a system that doesn't allow private actors to exploit the discrimination in the private market. But we also have to attack exclusionary zoning, which hasn't been done. There was some progress at the end of the last federal administration to put out what were called affirmatively furthering fair housing rules. And those have been basically pulled back by the current administration. And they weren't dramatic. They were basically saying, localities, if you want federal housing funds, you need to examine where you are excluding people of color, where you are not furthering fair housing, or we might reduce that funding. And the current administration, despite its claim to want to continue fair housing, has put basically a hold on that.
Well, we want you to stick around. We're going to be hearing about situations for affordable housing in Macon from Grant Blankenship of GPB, and also just examining this idea of who owns affordable housing? I think many people in our culture think, well, affordable housing, it has a lot of old associations of housing projects, of, you know, not in my backyard, someplace else. But really looking at how it affects all of us, whether you can afford looking for housing yourself or you cannot. Just a minute before we wrap, any thoughts on that as we go into the break?
Well, the reality is for lower income people, a great deal of affordable housing, I would argue a majority of it, is privately owned. The amount of publicly owned affordable housing has shrunken greatly and is continuing to shrink. I think that's actually a bad thing. But basically, much of housing by lower and moderate income people that you see could be affordable housing. You wouldn't be able to detect it just by looking at it.
Well, Dan Emmergluck, he's sticking with us. He's a professor in the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Just ahead, what chance do you stand of getting public housing? And later in the show, an appreciation of the legacy of the late celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stay with us.